afternoon, everybody. It's straight up 1 o'clock. Welcome to the House Resources Committee. It is Friday, thank God, January 25th, 2013. With us is the whole gang, Representative Johnson, Representative Tuck, Representative Hawker, Co-Chair Feige, Representative Wilson, Representative Olson, Representative Tarr, and Representative Seaton, and myself, Co-Chair Sadler. Representative Josephson is in the audience someplace back there, and you lost your chance when Mike showed up, but you got your place. As always, please kill your cell phones at this time. Don't just turn them to silent. They will still affect the system if they're on vibrate. And, of course, the Honeycrisp apples wait the violations.
Not to make friends that call you later.
Those are not friends that call. Those are Bill Stoltz. We are here this afternoon to take up the governor's bill, House Bill 80, cruise ship wastewater discharge permits. And I believe, we have Department of Environmental Conservation Commissioner Lira Hartig, who will introduce the bill and walk us through it for about 30 minutes. He has another obligation in the building at a different committee, at which point he will turn it over to his Deputy Commissioner Lynn Kent and Water Resource Director Michelle Bonet Hale. I'd like to welcome Commissioner Hartig to the stand, the rostrum podium.
Hot seat.
Hot seat, yes. For the record, would you both give us your names and then, Commissioner, give us your presentation?
Yes, thank you, Chairman Sadler and members of the committee. My name's Larry Hartig. I'm the Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. And with me today is our Deputy Commissioner Lynn Kent. I apologize that I do have a House Finance meeting that I better be at 1:30. Our deputy here and Michelle, our division director, are more than capable, I'm sure, of answering any questions. And my plan today, if it's the will of the group, would be just to give a little bit of a historical background on how we got here, from at least DEC's perspective. What are the main components in the bill, HB 80? And then I'd like to talk about what it is and what it isn't, because cruise ships, like a number of other discharges around the state, we have a whole set of regulations that deal with them. And this bill only is a piece of that. I'm sure there's concerns that arise that you'll hear about that are really addressed elsewhere in our statutes and in our regulations. And I'd like to point some of those out to kind of orient what this bill is and what it isn't. And then I would certainly leave time for questions, hopefully, before I have to leave.
Certainly. Proceed.
Okay. Thank you. As background, again, give this historical perspective. Cruise ships have been under scrutiny for some time in Alaska, at least 10 years, their discharges. Going back to late 90s, 1999, there was real concerns about some of the discharges from cruise ships and what impact that may be having to the Alaska environment. And the state was pretty aggressive in looking at that, and requirements were imposed on cruise ships. And by 2004, they were all required, the larger cruise ships were required to have what's called advanced wastewater treatment systems. And these systems aren't all the same. When we say advanced wastewater treatment systems, this is a class of systems. There's different manufacturers. They may be a little bit different in what they do in terms of performance as to individual pollutants. But as a class, they were recognized as the best at the time. And so by 2004, all the large cruise ship vessels operating in Alaska had this best technology that was recognized at the time. In 2006, there was a citizens initiative that passed, and it did a number of different things. I think that the big thing it did, it imposed certain taxes on cruise ships. There were concerns at the time that they were using infrastructure in Alaska, even on a temporary basis, but they weren't paying taxes to help support that. Some of the other requirements that were in that initiative was that these large cruise ships operating in Alaska would be required to have a permit issued by the state if they were going to discharge in state waters, basically waters within 3 miles of our shores. Up to that point in time, there wasn't a permit requirement, and there was no federal requirement. So this was totally new. So going in with this initiative, we had that. We also had a requirement in there that not only do they have to have a permit, but one of the conditions of the permit, if they were going to discharge in Alaska waters, is they had to meet state water quality standards at the point of discharge. And I'll define two of those terms. First, water quality standards. Water quality standards are required of every state under the Federal Clean Water Act, and those are designed to protect what are called designated uses. Water bodies are designated for particular uses in the state, such as drinking water, recreation, aquatic life. That would include all aquatic life, not just salmon, but everything down to the microorganisms. And so these are water quality standards we set, DEC has the statutory authority to set those for the state. We do that through a regulatory process. We have a regular process to review our standards under federal law. We have to at least every 3 years. When we decide that it's ripe to issue a new standard, we notice that as a change in regulation. It goes through public review and comment, and then the regulation is final. But we're not done yet. It still has to go to EPA for approval before we can use it. That's a federal requirement. And there they do consultations, Endangered Species Act consultations, Stevens Magnuson Act, Essential Fish Habitat consultation, tribal consultation. And only after EPA's done and approved it, then it becomes a regulation in the state that we can use, a water quality standard that we can use. That process, in my experience, is a 4 to 10 year process. So when we do a water quality standard, when we propose one, we're pretty darn sure it's the right number. And there's plenty of opportunity for public input, plenty of opportunity for appeals, and often there are appeals. So anyway, a water quality standard then is used then to determine how much of a pollutant can go into a water, because again, we're protecting the use of that water, and the water quality standard says this is how much that water body can take before you start affecting that use adversely. And so we look at each permit application and say how much pollutant can be allowed that won't exceed the water quality criteria, you know, for that water body. So at the point of discharge, what does that mean? At the point of discharge is that point within the ship, just where the effluent leaves the ship before it enters the water. So if you apply water quality criteria at the point of discharge, it means it's in the pipe in that ship before it just leaves the ship. So that means that water that's being discharged, it has to be drinkable. You'd have to be able to swim in it. Fish would have to be able to live and thrive in it, and all the microorganisms, if it was going to meet water quality criteria. That's how clean it would have to be. Well, the experience with these wastewater treatment systems coming after 2006, you know, we were requiring permits, we were monitoring ships for compliance, we had good data on how their performance was at that time. Again, they all had these advanced wastewater treatment systems as of 2004, so that's what we were viewing, how well these systems were doing. And they were doing relatively well. They were meeting the water quality criteria for all pollutants but four. And those were ammonia and dissolved copper, nickel, and zinc. Now, they were doing better, by and large, than shore-based facilities. You know, so if you look at public wastewater treatment systems up and down the coast, they were doing better than they were in terms of water quality criteria. But they were not consistently meeting water quality criteria in a pipe. So in 2009, the legislature passed HB 134. And that did a number of things. It still it didn't do away with the permit requirement, but allowed DEC on a temporary basis to issue wastewater discharge permits to the large cruise ships that relieved them from the at the point of discharge as long as they were using the waste treatment that was most technologically effective and economically feasible. And what it also did is it established a science advisory panel to look at what is the state of white wastewater treatment from cruise ships. Are advanced wastewater treatment systems as a class still the best that's on the market? Is there something better? Now, it only had been a few years. We're talking about 2004 now to 2009, 5 years. So, I'm sure there's some skepticism whether had been a leap in technology. But this panel was convened. It had 11 members, experts, including German engineers, literally, coming over, people that build ships, design ships for a living that go all over the world. And they came together in a series of 15 meetings that were open to the public. They held a workshop here in Juneau to invite the public in to see what they were doing, what they had looked at in terms of different systems, what their findings were, and a comment on those. And then they issued a preliminary report. And they weren't required to issue a report, but they chose to issue a preliminary report to DEC. And then we took that report and we turned it into we added it as an addendum to our own preliminary report. We concurred in the findings of the panel, and we delivered that to the legislature earlier this month. Now, some of the key findings in the science advisory panel report that DEC concurred with is one that the advanced wastewater treatment systems, again, the ones that were incorporated in ships in 2004, are the best available technology. You can't go out there and purchase and get something and put on ships that's better as a class of treatment. Also, that looking at all the data that we have from the performance of these ships, that they were largely able to meet water quality criteria at the point of discharge, except for those four parameters I already described, the ammonia and the three dissolved metals. The other thing that they said, I think, that is particularly interesting in terms of this bill, is that they didn't see anything on the horizon. There wasn't anything they could point to that they could say within the next 3 years or in the near term that would be become available that they thought could be incorporated onto large cruise ships that would allow them to meet this at the point of discharge requirement for all parameters. And that's important because, again, DEC's authority to allow relief from that standard, in other words, allow mixing zones, as we call them, sunsets at the end of calendar year 2015. Now, a little bit about climbing. The current permit that they're discharging under, they did last season, 2012 cruise season, that permit expires early April. The first cruise ship season, ship that'll show up here that'll need a permit to discharge will arrive in late April. And so DEC will have to issue a new permit in time relatively quickly, and we're working on a new permit, and we'll be able to put that out, public notice, get the permit issued. But it would be under the existing law, the law that they're struggling to meet now. If the legislature changes the law, then we would have to adapt to that and try to issue a permit quickly before the start of the discharge season. Or what we can do is try to work some kind of transition. So with that, I'll go into the bill and try to be pretty brief here, just kind of give the highlights of it, and then answer any questions, of course. What is
questions on the history?
Actually, I'd like to let them. His time is limited, and Representative Tucker, I'd like to let the commissioner go through his presentation. Well, first.
Certainly, the deputy will be here to be able to answer questions on history and everything else. On SB 29, what it does is it removes the requirement that wastewater or that water quality criteria be met at end of pipe, and it makes cruise ships treated like other wastewater discharges. They don't have to meet that at end of pipe, but in order for them to get relief from that requirement, they need a mixing zone. In order to get a mixing zone, one, they would have to have an advanced wastewater treatment system. So you don't get a mixing zone unless you have the best system that we know of on board your vessel. So it maintains that high standard for the current vessels and any vessels that might come in terms of large cruise ships. And second, you have to meet our mixing zone regulations, the requirements of those. And if you go to them, our mixing zone regulations, you'll see there's extensive criteria in there. You don't just apply for and get a mixing zone. You have to be able to show that, among other things, that salmon passing through that area aren't going to be impacted. You're going to have to show that there's not going to be bioaccumulation, in the sediments or elsewhere. There's a whole set of things that you have to be able to show. And those apply not just to cruise ships, those apply to any discharger in the state that's wanting a mixing zone. So that's one thing. The other thing it does is it does allow for a transition period so that the permit that we issued in 2010, rather than expiring early April, it would continue until 2015 unless we replaced it with a new permit under the new law. Presumably that's what we would do if SB 29 passes. And that transition, what that would do is then that would allow us not to have to issue a permit, withdraw a permit, issue a new permit, and have people scramble over the next 4 months and people not know what they have to comply with in the interim period. The other thing it does is we haven't talked yet about the small cruise ships. I talked about large cruise ships, but I haven't talked about the small ones. There's small ones by definition are ones that have fewer than 250 lower berth, passenger berths. And on those, what we've been doing is we've been putting them under what I would call a best management plan, where they have to manage their waste and the discharge and disposal of that waste under best practices, rather than having a permit with set limits in it. If this law doesn't pass, this statute doesn't pass, or this bill doesn't pass, then what happens is in 2015, even those small ships would be required to meet that at the point of discharge requirement. So all cruise ships, small, large, would have to meet that requirement. And the science panel didn't even look at them, because if the big ones can't make it, the small ones are going to have a much more difficult time based on limited space and power needs and holding times and tankage and all of that. So that would give the small cruise ships to be able to give the small cruise ships, it would allow a transition there too, where we could extend the best management plan coverage, and then the sunset for them, 2015 would go away, and we could continue after that date to manage them under these plans. What it doesn't do, what the bill doesn't do, it doesn't change water quality standards. So if copper's a concern or nickel's a concern, whatever, that it's you know, copper's copper. If it's a problem from cruise ships, it's probably a problem from mines. It's probably a problem from seafood processing plants, smaller vessels, any kind of vessel, from public-owned treatment systems. I mean, we all have copper pipes in our homes, so if copper pipes are the problem, then there's a bigger problem than cruise ships. But all these issues are looked at under water quality standards. Again, there's federal requirements all around. There's a federal structure that we follow to change those. There's a public process we follow, and that's where that would go. The science panel, they didn't look at water quality criteria. That wasn't their job. That wasn't their expertise. That wasn't their mission. The other thing that it doesn't do is it doesn't change our mixing zones. So all these other requirements that are in our mixing zones to protect the aquatic life, to protect the environment, those are there. Those aren't relaxed. The other thing it does, though, it does sunset the science advisory panel. This panel is, like I say, like the third step along the way. We had the changes in the early 2000s where there was a panel. DEC, under its existing authority, which continues after this bill, we had a technology conference. We invited experts from around the world to come in and vendors to look at different technologies here in Juneau. And then we had the science panel, and all three came up with the same thing. These are the best systems that you got. And since there's nothing on the rise, and the question is, why would we have these people come in from Germany and everywhere else to sit and tell us the same thing over the next 3 years, particularly when DEC already has the authority and the duty to continue to look at emerging technology, and it's not for cruise ships, but for other dischargers. And we can certainly still hold technology conferences. We can do it more targeted way where we can look at specific things that we want to look at rather than the broad spectrum like the panel had. And if we need additional resources to do that, we can always come back to the legislature and ask for a capital increment. And we've done that in the past in other instances when we needed to do a large technology conference. So those are my prepared remarks. Sorry for the running through them quick like that.
That's okay. You can talk slower than I do. That's great. Any questions from committee? For Commissioner Hardig? Representative Tuck, ask first. And
thank you, Mr. Seaton. Chair. When you said, talking about 2004 water quality standards that the Fed has to do, and you said it's a 4 to 10 year process, that's for the state of Alaska because of our, because we handle the water ourselves. That's for us, the state of Alaska, to meet their requirements for our regulations. Is that correct, or are you talking about a 4 to 10 year process for a cruise line industry to get a permit?
Representative, through the chair, I know I ran through this pretty quick. I have to make a distinction. Under primacy that we have from EPA, when we talk about primacy, what we're talking about is the authority to issue permits. And that's something that the state applied for and got from EPA. Water quality standards is a totally different subject. We take the standards and we put them in permits, but the authority to do water quality standards, that arises directly under the Clean Water Act. We have the same authority every other state has, and it was what Congress gave us and what the legislature gave DEC specifically. And so the requirements we follow there, it's the same for every state. It doesn't matter whether it's cruise ships or anybody else. When we set those standards, those are statewide standards, and they're set following that federal process that all other states follow.
Okay. Follow up, Mr. Chair. So just a distinction, the 4 to 10 year process was for our ability to issue permits through the feds.
Representative, again through the chair, the 4 to 10 years we're talking about my experience in getting water quality criteria through from the time period that DEC proposes a change in a standard to the public and opens the regulatory process to the time it's gone through all of that state process and then the EPA review and their consultations and working us all the way through. It's just what I was trying to say is that there has to be a lot of science, there's a lot of eyes on it, because a lot of people are affected by these change in standards. So if we were going to change a standard for copper, what I was trying to point to is it wouldn't be a panel that would one day meet and say, we think the copper is too strict or not strict enough, we want to change it. There's a different process. It's a mandatory process, and it's a long, rigorous process to set a standard.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Seaton, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Under the existing statutes, we have special areas designated by fish and game, critical habitat areas. State critical habitat area is very distinct from polar bear or beluga whale habitat, federally designated. And those are very specific, and I'm reading here, protect and preserve habitat areas especially crucial to the perpetuation of fish and wildlife and to restrict all other uses not compatible with the primary purpose. You know, I've talked to the cruise ship industry. They do not discharge in those areas. Does DEC have any problem with making sure that the bill contains the restrictions so that discharges couldn't occur in those areas that were above the water quality standards of the state?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, we have the statutory authority right now, specifically as to cruise ships, but it would apply to any dischargers generally, to restrict when, where, and how they discharge. And some of the restrictions you're talking about that cruise ship companies acknowledge, those are ones that are in our permit. We could put more in there. And so I would, my, not to diminish the role of this body in any way, shape, or form, but if we were going to decide when, where, and how, that's something we could do at a permitting level. And if that could change over time, it may be that there's another area that we think needs to be protected, and maybe it can't go through the whole process of being formally designated as a protected area. We can deal with that in the permit. And so when we propose a permit, we put a draft permit out there, and it would identify the when, where, and how that one could discharge. And it would specify which areas, and there's areas right now in our general permit where the people can't discharge. Those would be laid out in a draft, and then certainly Fish and Game, U.S. Fish and Wildlife, anybody that's interested could come forward and say, these areas should be off limit, and we would have the authority to write that right in there.
Follow up.
Sure, follow up.
And regardless, excuse me, one other point, though, I think was in part of your question, excuse me, it would be that regardless, they would have to meet our water quality criteria at the edge of any mixing zone. In that mixing zone, then we could define when and how they could operate to be have that mixing zone. For instance, we could require that they be underway so that we'd have that 50,000 to 1 dilution, that instantaneous dilution, so that there wouldn't be any impact. And we could restrict how many vessels and when they could be, so you wouldn't have to worry about the total quantity. I mean, there's lots of things we can regulate under a permit that way to deal with that, where we have lots of tools.
Good deal. Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Just to clarify, Commissioner, you said if this bill does not pass, that small vessels that are currently exempted from the more stringent wastewater treatment standards would then, they would lose that exemption, or that exemption would sunset, and then the small cruise ships less than 250 passengers would then be required to put those advanced wastewater treatment systems in?
Co-Chair Feige, through the chair, that's very close to it. What I'd say is that their ability to operate under these best management plans, as I call them, would sunset, and they would have to, if they were going to discharge in Alaska water, they'd have to meet our water quality criteria at the end of pipe.
Which, and I would guess is economically not.
So they would have to choose not to discharge in Alaska waters, and especially with a smaller vessel, I don't know that they have that holding capacity where they could continue to operate. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Thank you. Representative Johnson.
Thank you, and this will be fairly quick. When you say under 250 people, would that include the Alaska ferries or fishing vessels that would have to comply with that?
Through the chair, I think there's a couple of our ferries that are under the best management plan, not all of them. I could, it's like the deputy's looking that up, but if I recall right, that there's a couple of them that are under the smaller and best management plan.
And no fish processors or fishing boats fall into that?
These are all commercial passenger vessels, so they would all have to have people they're carrying for hire versus fishing vessels that we're talking about under this law.
And a follow-up to your follow-ups.
Did does the Alaska ferry system, fishing vessels, and people that don't carry have discharge?
Certainly.
Is it treated in any way?
They have. There's a lower level of treatment called marine safety devices that are required under Coast Guard federal rules that don't have the same effluent quality, lesser effluent quality than the advanced wastewater treatment systems like the large cruise ships have. I'm not sure under what which vessels have to have at least that level, but by and large, no, they wouldn't have the same treatment level, same quality of effluent.
One more follow-up, if I could.
Last one.
No mixing zones required for those vessels?
No permits required, no mixing zones required. Now, there is EPA looking at some of the, getting some of these vessels under permits. Right now, some of them are under, I think, best management practices as opposed to having effluent limitations like we're talking for cruise ships. I think with that, I'm probably about out of time, but I'll leave my depth here.
Actually, given the interest of time, I had myself down next. I'm going to ask a brief question, okay, and then Representative Tarr and then Representative Wilson. But Commissioner, I'm coming in this morning, I heard the radio, and I heard this bill characterized as reducing Alaska's wastewater discharge standards or reducing the water quality standards.
No.
I even heard the term that says going to gut our water quality standards. What will be different about discharge levels or toxicity in the next 3 years? It's been different from the last 3 years if this bill passes.
The water quality criteria, you said, aren't changing. This bill could not change the state water quality criteria. I mean, I don't believe if the legislature changed the copper standard tomorrow, since it's outside the federal mandated process, I don't know what would happen, you know, because we have Ninth Circuit law that says until EPA puts a stamp of approval on it, we can't put it in at least federal permits. We might be able to put it in a state-issued permit that doesn't invoke any federal law, but it wouldn't be under any federal permit. It would create a kind of interesting situation.
Thank you. And two quick questions, and Representative Tarr, then Wilson. Mm-hmm.
Sure. So I had the opportunity to speak with the commissioner, and so I was able to address some of my concerns. You know, something specifically we haven't talked about in terms of the mixing zone or the continuous, the, you know, permittees that are allowed to have the continuous discharges. I think that could be an area of concern versus some permittees that are required to be underway and traveling, so that, you know, the idea that the dilution factor is happening more quickly. So I think that's an area of concern for me and something I might want to bring up. And there was a couple of other things. You know, one opportunity might be to just extend the compliance period. So there's no known technology right now that would meet this stronger standard. But if we, instead of changing the law in this way, extended the period with which they had to meet that standard, you know, what do you estimate would happen, you know, that technology might be developed if the period were extended? Could that be an alternative to this approach?
Yeah, Representative Tarr, through the chair, I don't know what that extension period would need to be. I mean, you could make it 100 years, I'd feel comfortable. But these are big ships, and they're built once, and they have a relatively long useful life. Mm-hmm. And so you'd have a question with people that are manufacturing ships where they should go ahead and build a ship now or wait because they don't know what the standard's going to be. You'd have people planning where to deploy their ships. And if Alaska was just kind of left up in the air where there was this date out there where the companies couldn't meet it and didn't know how they would meet it or whether that standard would stay there, I think it would just create a lot of uncertainty. And if we want to drive technology, there's many ways one can drive technology. If what you really want to do is say, we think reverse osmosis should work, well, put an X Prize out there, or, you know, hire the University of Alaska to put its engineers at work. The science panel won't do that. These are volunteers. They're not going to get there and bench test and pilot study. And before they put these systems on ships, these companies have to know they're going to work, too. Mm-hmm. They can't be out in the middle of the ocean and find these things don't work. And there's a lot of other considerations in them. And these systems go in, and there has to be the weight and balance. There's how much storage capacity, how much energy. What you do with a waste treatment system, it doesn't just cause the waste to disappear. It goes somewhere else. And so how do you manage that? I mean, what waste stream do you create? What do you do with that new waste stream? Mm-hmm. And so there's a lot of considerations. It isn't just taking a technology out and saying, here it is in the theories today, and here is on the bench tomorrow, and here it is in a pilot, and now it's on board all ships. It doesn't happen very quickly. So to put a date out there, just I think would create uncertainty. It's just whether you know, if you put it far out enough, I guess people wouldn't worry about it. But if you're really trying to drive technology and make it happen quick, then I think you start, as we've seen over the last few years, really cause some disruptions. Right, or they do need
it
to move.
I
can excuse myself.
It's
one of his. For the record, that was Representative Craig Johnson. Thank you, Commissioner, for your time here.
Thanks.
And
everyone.
Deputy Commissioner Kent, if you'd take the hot seat to slide in.
Absolutely.
We have some questions. We have been joined by Representative Cotulla. And if you would come up and state your name, actually put both yourselves in the record. There's a question from Representative Wilson and probably some more.
Great. Thank you. My name is Lynn Kent, and I'm the Deputy Commissioner at Department of Environmental Conservation. And I'm going to hopefully shuffle a mic without unplugging anything.
My name is Michelle Bonnet-Hale, and I am the Director of the Division of Water, Department of Environmental Conservation.
Representative Wilson, do you have a question?
Yes, my question was, we have a lot of sports charter fishermen, but they carry passengers. And so are they in this group that if we don't make this change, that they would now have to comply?
Representative Wilson, through the chair, they would not be required to comply with those requirements. This, the legislation and the laws right now currently apply to commercial passenger vessels that carry passengers for hire. And the small ones, I think you heard the commissioner say, they're defined as commercial passenger vessels that carry 249 or have 249 or fewer lower berths on the vessel. And Co-Chair Sadler, if you don't mind, I'd be happy to answer the question about the ferries that we
certainly
had a few minutes ago. There are five Alaska Marine Highway System ferries that are considered small commercial passenger vessels, and those are operating under best management plans right now. We have none that meet the definition for a large commercial passenger vessel.
Okay. Seeing no questions, I'm going to ask a few myself, actually. Deputy Commissioner, could you give a little more amplification as to the Science Advisory Panel's process, composition, and some of the parameters under which they operated, what they were and were not supposed to do, and how they operated, and how much there would or would not be left to do?
I'd be happy to do that, Mr. Chairman. The Science Advisory Panel was convened under HB 134, as the commissioner said, and we had 11 members on that panel. There were statutory requirements for the kinds of expertise they needed to have, things like wastewater treatment expertise water quality type expertise. And the panel members that we ended up with came from other Alaska communities, they came from other countries, they came from the lower 48, so we had a broad representation, and we were very lucky to have the level of expertise that we had with that group. We had the folks who design and construct boats and ships, and those who design and construct the wastewater treatment systems that are on board the vessels right now, as well as people from academia who are looking at laboratory type research. It was a very broad group. I had a list of the types of expertise. We had people with expertise in wastewater plant design and operation, wastewater engineering and science, ship engineering, design and construction, environmental science, shipping economy, fisheries, and environmental policy. So it was a very broad group. They met over a series of, almost 2 years now. I think they had a combination of face-to-face meetings here. We flew people in from Europe and a few teleconferences. They kind of scoured the planet to see what was available there in terms of wastewater treatment that's available now in other countries, other ships, and even in other industries that might be applicable to the cruise ships, and really did a very thorough job. They weren't required to give us a formal report, but they chose to convey their information and their recommendations to us in a formal report, and that's the report that we appended to our analysis. So they were very helpful to us. All of their meetings included opportunity for public comment. I think we even had public comment multiple times a day sometimes. We tried to make it as broad as possible to allow people to participate.
Okay, thank you. Questions from the committee? Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Linda, are there countries worldwide that the same cruise ships that fly Alaskan waters also operate? Do other countries have similar wastewater treatment requirements? I mean, or is Alaska simply in that particular category kind of the top of the pile?
Representative Feige through the chair, when we first started down this path with the Citizens Initiative and the very strict requirements for meeting the water quality standards at the point of discharge, the standards around the world vary some, but I think at that point in time we felt like ours were probably the most strict in the world. I haven't looked recently to see if other jurisdictions have done something similar or how their standards compare, but I think the laws here in Alaska really drove the vessels 10 years or so to install advanced wastewater treatment systems. And I guess the good news is when they go to other countries, they don't just turn them off. They're still on board the vessels and still operating there, but they're not required around the world.
Thank you.
Representative Seaton, good question.
Thank you. When we're talking about best management practices, is that a list of practices that they must do, or is that them listing the practices they follow and then we approving whatever practices they've submitted?
Representative Seaton through the chair, Director Hale might be able to answer that in more detail than I can, but my understanding is that each vessel has to submit a plan on what they're doing to reduce their waste, to make sure it's as clean as possible, to look at where they might discharge in the most safe locations. They have to submit those plans to us for our review and approval. And Michelle, I don't know if you have more detail on
what goes into them.
It includes everything from, you know, what kind of products are they using on board that might be affecting their wastewater, where they moor their vessels, when they allow their passengers to shower. they're pretty extensive.
Thank you. So these are individually submitted by the vessels of what they're doing. Have we denied any of those best practice plans that have been put forward, or are those all basically approved as they come from the individual ship telling us what they're doing?
Representative Seaton through the chair, early on, I think we were disappointed in some of the plans that we got, and rather than just disapprove them, we worked with the vessel owners and operators to see what they could do to beef them up, and kind of looked at all of them that were submitted and shared with vessels who didn't have as robust of a plan some of the ideas that were coming in on the other plans, just so that we could kind of bring them all up to a level of doing the best that they absolutely can when they're discharging in Alaska waters.
If I may ask briefly, let me ask a clarifying question there. So best available technology, is that something we have to convene a science panel to do, or is DEC allowed to or barred from applying that standard?
Co-Chair Sadler, DEC already has statutory authority to do things like convening technology workshops. In fact, the first big technology workshop we did long before HB 134 passed, where we again brought people in from a wide variety of places to help us evaluate technology. And we have an opportunity and an obligation with each permit renewal, which are, generally, except for the cruise ships right now, are on a five-year cycle, to look at technology and to ensure not just cruise ships, but our other wastewater dischargers are really kind of using the best technology that they can.
Thank you. Representative Tuckle.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Under the best managed practices, your explanation made it sound like that we do know what is being discharged from ships. You're able to find that information out? Or is that information, do you test for that information? Or is that information given you by the cruise lines? Or how do we know what's being discharged?
Representative Tuck through the chair, for the large commercial passenger vessels that are under permits, there are requirements for self-monitoring. We inspect those vessels. We sometimes take our own independent samples to verify that the monitoring data that they're conducting is really representative of what's coming off of the vessels. For the smaller vessels, I would have to defer to Michelle or maybe get back to you on our level of oversight for the smaller vessels. I don't believe they're required to do any monitoring.
And follow up, Mr. Chair.
Representative.
So when you do sometimes your own testing, what prompts the test? Is it random? Is it periodically? Or how is that scheduled?
You know the schedule on it? Representative Tuck through the chair. It's generally, I would call it random, where we look at vessels of opportunity when they're in port, because that's when it's easiest for us to get to them. But having said that, you know, we do have ocean rangers who are on board the vessels the whole time, too. who are observing what the operations are on vessels.
Okay. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Question, Representative Tarr.
And just to clarify on that point, the Ocean Rangers, that was part of the program created through the Citizen Initiative, and those folks are paid for by the cruise ships themselves.
Representative Tarr, through the chair, the Ocean Rangers are on board all the large commercial passenger vessels, and they're paid for by DEC. They're under a contract, contractor that's hired by DEC. Mm-hmm. The fund source, though, is a fee on the cruise ships, but it does come through DEC.
Director, the absence of questions I got to ask, could you define the terms, give us a little bit more of the thought behind technically feasible, economically practical, those kinds of things? Those are wonderful words, but how do they translate in the real world?
If I may, Mr. Chairman, I'd like to turn to Director Hale because she's been a lot more steeped in the conversations with the science panel over those very terms.
Is your question for Director Kent? Or
actually, it's kind of follow-up.
Representative Feige.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of follow-up on Representative Tuck's question about monitoring. I mean, you go out and periodically test and observe, and I'm sure people complain and react to that. But what are the potential penalties for, you know, a cruise ship that violates these wastewater treatment standards? Are they sort of in the misdemeanor range? Or are they in the large dollar amount range? What's the magnitude of the penalty?
Representative Feige, through the chair, we do have an attorney online, I think, Ruth Hamilton Hesse, with the Attorney General's office, and she's probably better able to answer that than I am, but there are both civil and criminal penalties for violations of the permits and of our water quality standards.
Okay, great. Let's ask that question. If we can go to our lifeline and ask, is AG Hesse available?
Yes, I am. Co-Chair Sadler, I'm online.
If you could state your name and make sure, do you hear the question?
I did.
Please put yourself on record and answer.
Sure. So my name is Ruth Hamilton Hesse. I'm a Senior Assistant Attorney General with the Alaska Department of Law, and I work with DEC on this program. And as I understand the question through the co-chair, the question is, are there penalties for which the cruise lines would be subjected to for violating their discharge standards? Is that correct?
We understand that there are penalties, but what is the nature of the penalty? What's the magnitude of the fine, that kind of thing?
Sure. So, yes, there are penalties applicable to discharge standards. I don't have all of the particulars at the ready right at the moment, but it's, if you go to 4603-760, there are per event violations and per day penalties that are paid for a violation, ranging from $5,000 per day and not more than $500 per day and not more than $100,000 per violation. Per day. There are also potential administrative and, I believe, criminal penalties, and that would go beyond just the violation of effluent standards. It would also include any monitoring or reporting violations, and I could get back to you with more detailed information about that, but certainly there are civil and criminal penalties and administrative penalties applicable to any violations.
Ms. Hesse, could you clarify, was that $100,000 per day per violation or just $100,000 per violation? Max?
So the civil penalty through the court would not be less than $500, no more than $100,000 for the initial violation,
mm-hmm.
and then not more than $5,000 for each day after that first violation.
Okay, good. Thank you. Great, and I think next in the queue was my question, but represents seeking a question for Director Kent, Deputy Commissioner Kent.
Yes, and whoever.
Fair.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chairman. Yes, I had asked about critical habitats, and then the discussion was that the department has the ability to restrict areas and those kind of things and permits. Is there any time in which DEC for a commercial passenger vessel would issue a permit of discharge at greater than the state standard at the end of the pipe, but greater than the state standard water quality for a special area that has been established under, what is it, 1620-500 ADF&G in law for those areas that are identified as critical for the perpetuation of fish and wildlife and restricting all of the things that would be in not compatible with the primary purpose. Is there any instance where you have issued those kinds of permits with those for those kind of discharges in those particular areas that are set aside under applicable law?
Representative Seaton, through the chair, I guess we have to speak about cruise ships, and then we have to speak about other kinds of discharges.
Cruise ships, the commercial passenger vessels is what I'm talking about.
Okay, thank you, Representative Seaton, through the chair. Under the current law, I don't believe that we have any large commercial passenger vessels that are discharging in those areas. I could be wrong on that. But the current permit has limitations in it right now for Glacier Bay and for Skagway area. I may need to get back to you with more detail on that.
Thank you. I'd like to follow up. I guess I'm concerned, we have Ketchikan Bay Critical Habitat Area, which is, a community that I represent. It's an area that has been designated under state law as critical habitat. And, I've talked to the cruise industry. They say they do not discharge there, and they wouldn't. But my concern is that if we set up a system that says, oh, it's okay, or every permit that's issued, we have to have people all over the state write in comments and to DEC trying to restrict the from each particular area where somebody is concerned, where I don't think DEC would give a permit for discharge in a critical habitat area that's been designated in law, even though it's under the fish and game statutes. I want to get over that hurdle so that we don't set up this problem, and unless we hear from the industry that they for some reason need the ability to discharge in those areas, I would like you to go back in your shop in this consideration of the bill and think about that as far as whether that would in any way restrict the ability of DEC for something that they would want to permit at some time. So thank you.
Thank you, Representative Seaton. Representative Johnson, question?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Along those same lines, are there discharge permits in Ketchikan Bay of any kind?
I imagine so. Representative Johnson, through the chair, almost all of the coastal communities have a marine discharge associated with their wastewater treatment facility, and all of those in that area of the state would have a mixing zone associated with
them. Even though it's a designated critical habitat?
Yeah, through the chair, yes, that's correct. Remember that the water quality standards are designed to protect anywhere in the state, whether or not it's a designated critical habitat or not. So anytime we're meeting the water quality standards, we should be protective of aquatic life. Mixing zone is an exception to those standards. And those mixing zones are as small as we can possibly allow them based on the treatment capabilities of the facility. And that's the one of the many reasons for having a five-year look back at those permits and having to renew them, is every 5 years the public gets an opportunity to comment again on that permit for a shore-based facility, for instance, and on that mixing zone, and whether or not it still makes sense to have it in that location for that community.
Yep. Mr. Chairman,
Representative Johnson.
Yeah, and this is going to be a recurring theme with me. Dirty water is dirty water. I don't care who's putting it in, right. And fairness is fairness. So I don't want a standard that is good for one while other people don't, and that includes Alaska Ferry System, cities, fishing vessels. If we're going to set a standard for clean water, I'm all for it. But we all need to be playing in the same playing field. No one wants cleaner water than me. We need to be fair about it. So thank you, Mr. Chairman.
I'm done editorializing.
No,
thank you.
Thank you. Representative Feige, then Tuck, then Carr.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Kind of along those lines, has anybody ever assessed the cost of bringing some of these municipal wastewater systems or other fishing vessels or whatever, bringing their discharge quality up to the same level as the cruise ship?
Representative Feige, through the chair, I don't know that there's an estimate anywhere that we could point to that says all community wastewater systems in Alaska, in order to meet point of discharge water quality standards, what that price would be. But I can tell you probably most of us in the room couldn't afford to flush our toilets if the community systems had to meet that kind of level of treatment. There's science and there's policy, and the policy call is really what allows us to have those mixing zones and really have that balance between protecting the water quality and making sure that we can all survive as a society, too. I do want to point out, though, that with this bill, our mixing zone requirements don't go away. Just because this bill makes some changes and may allow cruise ships to have a mixing zone, that doesn't mean they automatically get one. There's a huge list of criteria that they have to demonstrate that they can meet in order for us to issue a permit that would allow a mixing zone. The same criteria that apply to the shore-based facilities, the seafood processors, the oil industry, the mining companies would also apply. And there's 19, 20 criteria that they would have to demonstrate.
I have Representative Tuck and then Tarr.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. When you talk about the stationary mixing zones that we have there, if I remember correctly, years ago when we looked at this bill once before, we had this topic up once before, one of the issues is that we have floating cities that are all over the place. So when you permit for mixing zones for these ships, are you doing it on an individual plan that doesn't overlap where other ships are dumping? Or do you look at that, even consider that? Or how do you consider the mixing zones and when and where a ship does discharge?
Yeah, thank you, Representative Tuck, through the chair. The current permit that the large commercial passenger vessels operate under is very specific to whether or not they are discharging underway or discharging when they're in port. And if they seek authorization to discharge while they're in port, their effluent limits are more strict. And we have looked at the cumulative impacts of multiple vessels in an area. When they're discharging underway, going 6 knots or more, the dilution of the effluent is so rapid as to be within seconds of coming out of the pipe of meeting the water quality standards. So there, we have looked at cumulative effects.
And may I follow up? Thank you, Mr. Chair. So when we have them underway, we're assuming that they're all not underway at the same spot, you know, having a train go through a caravan and they're all like dumping. Is that assumed, or is that something you regulate and control?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, we're not regulating the path that the cruise vessels follow and how many can go through an area in a specific time when they're underway, like if they're traveling between here and Haines. But the dilution of a discharge from a moving vessel meets the water quality standards before that water gets to the stern of the ship, basically. So the next ship coming through is really in basically clean water.
Okay. So if I may follow up. So it's we're looking at just more the dilution, how fast they're going, but not where, when, and what path. You know, you don't take those in consideration at all.
Representative Tuck, through the chair, we do look at the paths that they follow. In fact, also under the Citizens Initiative, the cruise vessels are required to report their location continuously, which I think we've read to mean every hour. So we can see the track of every large cruise vessel and where they go, and we do look at those.
Mm-hmm. And one last follow-up.
Last point.
Would it be helpful for you to know, even though you're not regulated, that they know when where they're going? They have to keep in touch with you, but would it be helpful for them to also give the information on when and how much they discharge?
Representative Tuck, through the chair, they are already required to tell us that as well.
Okay.
They're supposed to tell us when they start and stop discharge.
Okay, thank you very much. Appreciate it.
Representative Tarr, question.
Thank you. I wanted to talk a little bit more specifically about the copper standard. So I think at this time we're using the EPA standard. Is that true?
Representative Tarr through the chair, copper is considered a toxic, and we do, I think we have just adopted the values that EPA has put out.
Okay. And some of the concern that I'm hearing is about the copper standard, that salmon are much more sensitive to copper, and so we should maybe have something that's more restrictive than the EPA standard. In what way is the department considering that, and how do you consider that a concern? One thing I've also read is that even something as simple as using plastic pipe over copper pipes might have an influence on the copper levels and the discharge, and so is something as simple as working with the CRUSIP industry to have them do some simple modifications like that an option?
Representative Tarr, through the chair, I think there were a couple questions there. I might start at the end and work backwards. When we first started working with the large commercial passenger vessels, we did have them looking at all of the systems on board their vessels. Some of them had copper pipes, some of them don't. Some of them replaced copper pipes. They looked at the products that they use on board. Some of them changed out certain products. So they were kind of looking at all of the sources where you might find copper on a vessel that could end up in the wastewater from the vessel. But regarding the water quality standards, I appreciate your question there. When EPA sets water quality standards, they go through a set of pretty rigorous tests. They look at, I think, 6 different levels of organisms. They're not all necessarily organisms that you find in Alaska, but they're comparable. Mm-hmm. They look at acute toxicity. They look at chronic toxicity. They look at lethality. And they come up with numbers where, remember, they're applying these across the country, so they have to be pretty conservative to catch every kind of situation. Those studies look very much at toxicology. There are recent studies that have looked at copper and potential behavioral impacts on fish. And DEC has looked at those studies. Copper's a big issue. With our water quality standards review that we need to do every 3 years, copper is always a topic. We're always trying to check to see if there's new science. 2 years ago, we held a session at the Alaska Forum on the Environment in 2010, in part in response to Representative Seaton's requests about copper, where we had a fish and game expert and a NOAA expert and a DEC expert kind of present the known science about copper. And at this point, we don't feel like we have sufficient data that would allow us to make a legally defensible change to the copper criteria. DEC, of course, isn't in a position to do our own kind of toxicity testing and behavioral testing, but we are very very much watching the new science closely.
And actually, Deputy Commissioner, pardon me, could you speak a little bit to the baseline levels of copper from natural sources versus copper as a source from wastewater, offshore-based, or any other wastewater treatment facility?
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair. We'll look that up for you.
If I could just add this, because I was just reading the report on page 84 of the report that came out. There's a statement that the Mendenhall River discharges 23 times more copper than all the cruise ships combined in a year. And the Mendenhall is a very small river, if we all know, from the glacier to the ocean. So that smaller river distributes 23 more times than all the cruise ships combined. What's a copper river? What do the rest of them do? So that's actually in the report on page 84, if you care to read it.
Would either of you witnesses care to amplify that or verify that or not?
Mr. Chairman, excuse me. The science panel did look at kind of a mass loading perspective, just more for informational purposes. From our perspective, what really matters is what's the concentration in the water where the fish or other critters might be exposed to it, as opposed to how many pounds went into a water body. Because a pound in a wheelbarrow is very different than a pound in a swimming pool, for instance. But I think the science panel wanted to put some perspective on just how much copper is going into the marine environment in Southeast Alaska from cruise ships versus a single natural source.
Yeah. Seeing the other questions, Representative Tuck, I'm going to make sure we have are fair to the people who have signed up to testify both in person and online. If you got a brief question, Representative Tuck, and then we'll go to testimony.
Okay. I know when we talked about this in the past, we
looked at potentially cruise ships being able to discharge into municipal water facilities. Was that taking place here in Juneau? Was that happening at all? Because I think there was talks about Juneau being able to handle the discharges. And if so, have there been more talks about that? Has there been any discussions with the SAP panel whether or not they look into the municipal treatment plants and how they're handling that?
Representative, talk through the chair. That was definitely a topic of panel discussion. And there is, I think there's at least one or two vessels that have discharged into the Juneau facility. It's very difficult for a shore-based facility to handle wide fluctuations in their flow and wide fluctuations in the quality of the wastewater that's coming into the facility. So if cruise ships with advanced wastewater treatment systems are treating their water first and putting it into a municipal system, they're going to flood that system with very clean water. Could kill the bugs because there's not a food source for the biological treatment process. If they flood it with untreated water, so the cruise ships don't treat it on board first, they may just overwhelm the system that way. So it's these systems are not something that just are plug and play. The operators have to watch the flow that's coming in, the quality of that flow. They're always tweaking the treatment system, and it would be very difficult for them. That's a long story, but the most important thing is that the effluent limits for the shore-based facilities are less stringent, if you will, than they are from the cruise ships right now. So the cruise ships are discharging basically cleaner water than we can produce with these shore-based plants right now.
And a quick follow-up?
Wes?
I know that one's in motion, one is stationary. I think some of the confidence that people have is having stationary facilities and having that control. But was there, when you said one or two ships a day, you're talking about one or two ships over a period of 20 years, one or two ships a day, one or two ships ever? Or what did you mean by one or two ships have done it?
Representative, talk through the chair. I think it's one or two ships a year might occasionally discharge to the Juneau facility.
Okay.
Great. Thank you. Yeah. Thank you very much, Deputy Commissioner Kent and Ms. Bonet Hale, for having to hold my question in advance in terms of time. I'd like to go to public testimony, and bear with me as I juggle between those who are here. I had going offline first for Anchorage LIO, Rick Rogers. Can you hear me, Mr. Rogers?
Yeah, hello?
Hello there. If you'd, thanks, Rick. If you'd put yourself on the record and give us your testimony on HB 80, please.
Thank you, Co-Chair Stadler. My name is Rick Rogers. I'm the Executive Director of the Resource Development Council. As most of you know, we're a statewide business association representing forestry, oil and gas, mining, tourism, and fisheries. And we're interested in growing our economy through responsible resource development. I'll try to be brief, but among RDC's legislative priorities, we're very interested and have been over the years in supporting a strong permitting process that is predictable, timely, efficient, and based on sound science and economic feasibility. We're very impressed with the tireless work of the cruise ship advisory panel and the guidance that Commissioner Hardig and Deputy Commissioner Kent, we really applaud them for leading this group. I understand they've met over 15 times and provided critical information that can help shape a more rational wastewater discharge policy for our cruise industry. It's clear after reading the findings of this advisory panel that meeting the current water quality standards at the point of discharge from cruise ships is not feasible and it's not necessary to protect public health and aquatic species. We believe that HB 80 establishes a policy that's based on sound science and economic feasibility. We have many RDC members who are small businesses and communities that rely on the business activity of the cruise industry. And so we are supportive of this effort. We encourage your continued deliberations and quick passage of HB 80 so we can have a more reasonable permit process and standards in place for the upcoming 2013 season. And that concludes my comments. Thank you for the opportunity.
Thank you, Mr. Rogers. And if you do have any written comments or other backup, please submit them to the committee.
All right, I will do. Thank you.
Thank you. It's my intention to try and let everybody who signed it to testify do so before we get into asking questions and so forth. Next, if you have with you there in Anchorage, Mr. Wetzel, Dave Wetzel. Is that correct, or is he at a different location? Okay. Mr. Dave Wetzel, if you can hear me.
Yes.
Fantastic. If you'd give us your name and affiliation for the record and give us your testimony briefly, please. Thank you.
Yes, Mr. Chair. My name is David Wetzel. I'm the owner of Admiralty Environmental in Juneau. We're the independent contractor who manages the sampling, monitoring, and testing of both the large and small cruise ships in Alaska. We've been doing so since the project started in 1999. During that time, I've reviewed and reported the majority of the data that's been produced for this project. So I have a pretty good perspective of the history of the monitoring of this program. And I wanted to start by saying that I do support the passage of HB 80. I think it's going to be a sound and practical solution. It's going to achieve something that's environmentally responsible for cruise ship monitoring. We have seen all the different types of major treatment systems that are in operation in Alaska and have sampled all of those and seen the results for it. I will say that these really are the best systems out there. The military is looking at adding some of these to their ships. They really are the top of the line right now. We do monitor many of the local municipal treatment systems in Southeast Alaska, and I'm pretty convinced that the systems that are on the ships are far superior to what's being done on land. I will also say that there's a remarkable consistency between the different results or the different advanced wastewater treatment systems and the results that they produce. There's also a lot of consistency between the different ships that employ the same system, as well as between the results for the same ship year to year. It's very difficult to take a piece of data or a group of data and identify without seeing what kind of ship or treatment system it is to differentiate between one and another. So right now, majority of the sampling is being performed underway where there's a significant amount of dissipation that occurs immediately. So as part of the current permit, that's really a part of the way the sampling program is being conducted. The data that we are seeing really does support the findings of the science panel. We are seeing that there are very low levels of these metals and ammonia in particular to start with, and there's quite a bit of removal that's going on between the influent that's coming into the ship, which is highly concentrated based on how the ships treat water, and the effluent that's going out. So based on the perspective we have between the local treatment plants and the ships, it really does seem sensible to apply the same strategy for effluent limitations that we apply to land-based treatment to then apply to the cruise ships. Another point to consider is a matter of scale. The actual volume that cruise ships discharge is significantly smaller than what's coming out of a wastewater treatment plant. And I believe Lynn Kent sort of alluded to that a few minutes ago with the amount of volumes that are going through and the difficulties with even trying to put a cruise ship discharge into a local municipal plant. And I will also say that throughout the industry, my experience in dealing with vessel owners is that they're all very committed to operating these advanced wastewater treatment systems in an optimal manner. And they're very also interested in meeting the regulations that are in front of them. And they really do monitor these systems on a day-to-day basis and are highly interested in what the results are. So I think it's really important to encourage vessels to use these advanced wastewater systems in the best way possible, because really the alternative would just encourage ships to discharge outside of regulated areas without any kind of treatment and really would result in a greater environmental impact. So my personal opinion is that the current state of treatment is highly effective, and I really do urge you to pass this legislation, which I think will allow a reasonable and consistent and thorough monitoring of cruise ships as a discharge, and will allow ADEC to produce a practical permit. Thank you. That's my comment.
Thank you, Mr. Wetzel. Appreciate your professional comments, and if you have them in writing, please submit them. And I'm going to encourage all witnesses to stay online, stay online if you could, in case there's questions that your area of expertise needs to be called on. I'm going to go next to in the room. We have Mr. Bob James to testify. Give your name for the record and who you affiliate or represent. And go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much, members of the committee, Mr. Chair. My name is Bob James. I live in Juneau. I'm a tour operator here in Juneau, and first of all, welcome back to Juneau. We really appreciate the work you guys come and do for us and for our state. So
thanks for the rain.
I'm glad you're back. I had to think a lot about whether to come here today. I'm not an expert in this topic, as many of us are not an expert, so I like to know what I'm talking about when I testify, and I can claim I really don't have a full grasp of the situation, but I am in this business, and I make my living at it. Many of my friends, my family, I'm going to be sending my children to college with what this business, the cruise business, does for me and many people I know in Juneau. So I had to come. I am bullish on cruising, and I'm bullish on what it brings to our economy in Alaska, and I think probably most of us in the state are. But I was able to come because I found an answer to my question about not knowing that, and as I like you, depend on expert advice, and I read quite a bit about what the Science Advisory Panel has found, what they've done, what they've looked at, and this is a panel that was appointed by this body to do the work that we need to have answers to, and they brought answers to me. I hope they bring answers to all of us as we make this difficult decision, but I do believe in this case that what I have found and read into the answers of this expert panel is that the discharge is compatible with the high standards we have in Alaska. It's compatible with the expectations of our guests who care a great deal about the place they are coming to visit. It's compatible with my employees who are here working in the summers because they not only find great opportunity in the economy in Alaska, but they care about this place and they love it and they want to be outside guiding people. It gave me the answer I needed, and I hope as you consider House Bill number 80 and make your difficult decisions here in the next few weeks that you will look at the expert that you have appointed and take into account the results they presented for you. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. James. I appreciate it. Next to testify, I'd like to go to Petersburg, Mr. Joseph Sebastian. Greetings from Juneau, Mr. Sebastian. I'm sure Vice Chair Peggy Wilson extends her greetings as well. If you can hear us okay, Mr. Sebastian?
Yes, sir.
Great. If you could give us your name and who you represent, and give us your testimony, please.
For the record, my name is Joseph Sebastian. I'm representing myself and my family, and I have been a commercial fisherman in Southeast Alaska for 35 years. My son is a fisherman. My daughter has worked in various aspects of the fishing industry. She's currently a fisherman. And my kids have worked their way through college on fishing boats. Our neighbors, who are fishermen, their son just bought a new boat and permit. Petersburg is a fishing town, as are many towns in Southeast Alaska. Newsflash, the biggest industry employer in the state of Alaska is the fishing industry. And this bill is bad for Alaska's fishing industry. Our industry's whole claim to clean, pristine waters and inlets has to have a foundation in reality and in sciences and in public perception. To compound the existing problems of 32 cruise ships a day, every day, for 5 months, day after day, pounding our shores, we also have ocean acidification taking place. Due to airborne carbon pollution settling in the ocean in amounts that change the water's pH factor. I never thought I'd live so long as to see our oceans be destroyed in my lifetime. It's shocking. Now we want to weaken and take a step back on our oceans. And this is going, I believe, to compound the problem. I was a little surprised when the legislature flew off the handle to protect gun rights by banning any bans. Well, what about our clean ocean and water rights? the same ocean we all make our livings from. I am happy to share all of Alaska's wonders with visitors. But these cruise lines, who take billions of dollars of profits every year from Alaska, if they are unwilling to uphold and protect our clean, pristine Alaskan waters, then they have no place here, and they are not welcome. This bill, HB 80, is a slap in the face to thousands of Alaska's fishing families and the fishing industry. Thank you, sir. And I also wanted to thank the committee for their thoughtful questions on a difficult subject. I've been listening in, and this is really a tough issue. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Sebastian. Appreciate your participation at a distance. Coming back to testimony from the room, could Mr. Dennis Young please? Is Mr. Young in the room? Very good. Give us your name and affiliation and 3 to 5 minutes if you could, sir.
No problem. I'm actually going to be shorter than that. Dennis Young with International Longshore West Union, Alaska Longshore Division, president here in Juneau, and I'm the Southeast Area Committeeman. Our testimony,
I think the secretary might not have said that. Can you say it one more time, please?
My name is Dennis Young. I'm with the International Longshore Warehouse Union. I'm the president of the Port of Juneau. I'm the Southeast Area Committeeman, represent all the ILW longshoremen in Southeast.
Thank you, sir.
This is, like everybody has basically been stating, this is a very tough decision. And right now, we don't necessarily have one position, and that's why I'm not coming to keep my comments brief. And we're looking at all the testimony and listening and gathering all the facts before we present something that will be in writing to everybody on this committee. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you, sir. And we'd welcome written testimony if you have that as well. Thank you. Continuing with folks in the room is Carla Hart here. Ms. Hart, if you give us your name and affiliation and give us your testimony, 3 to 5 minutes, please.
Thank you. My name is Carla Hart. I'm here today on behalf of the Alaska Community Action on Toxics, and as a long-term person who's watched the cruise industry since the early 80s and first was aware of the cruise ships dumping in the so-called donut holes in Inside Passage long before 1999 when the commissioner mentioned this is a long-standing issue in terms of protecting the waters of Southeast Alaska and all of coastal Alaska. The rush for this bill is surprising to me, and I believe it's not warranted or appropriate. The scientific review process is not complete. The scientific review panel has not disbanded, even though the commissioner and DEC staff spoke of it as a past tense. They issued what I understand to be a draft report in November. It's a scientific review panel, and as typical with science, you issue a draft report, you get peer review, you get comments, and then you come back and revisit those, and so that you make sure that your report has the rigor and the responses that it needs. And that hasn't happened yet. So the process from the scientific review panel is not complete, and a final report should be issued before you're moving forward. The public has not had much opportunity to comment at this point on this process. The bill was introduced a week ago. It seems to be moving quickly. The cruise industry on other issues and topics related to them has always expressed that they have a very long time frame for planning and that they can't respond to things that are done quickly. We can't have taxes now because we plan 2 years out, price 2 years out. We can't do this because we're planning far out in advance. The artificially created urgency that we have for passing this bill because of permits coming up in April seems disingenuous to me. Surely the cruise industry has plans in place and are able to issue their permits and move forward with this summer. So I think if you take the time to give proper consideration to this, you won't risk the cruise industry for this year, and you will respect all of the voters in Alaska who voted to have this clean water element of the initiative. And although Commissioner Hardy characterized the 2006 initiative as primarily being a tax bill, Alaskans care about clean water and healthy fisheries a lot. I don't think that they passed it just as a tax bill. The clean water part was very important, and there had been some pretty high-profile pollution instances that made that pretty important to Alaskans. The volume size of cruise ships was mentioned by the prior, the person who testified from Petersburg. Most of the ships that we're talking about are larger than most of the communities in Alaska. We have a lot of ships floating around. If an Alaska community doesn't meet discharge standards at their pipe, we know where that pipe is, and if you're living there, you have to deal with it in your front yard, and you know that you can avoid it if you're harvesting subsistence foods. The discharge from ships can be anywhere, so you could be in an area that seemed incredibly remote and pristine, and yet you might have the misfortune of being right after there had been some repetitive discharge. And the more that we learn about very, very, very small concentrations of different pollutants in the water and how they can have an impact on human health, it's really critical that we protect our health. I understand that some of the ships are already meeting targets at times and that they're improving their ability to hit them consistently. Ships can keep operating and moving toward better technology over the next few years while the existing law is in place. I appreciated Representative Tarr's idea of extending the period to meet the criteria if that's necessary. Instead of backing off, let's keep the cruise industry under the pressure to increase their standards. I also appreciate Representative Johnson's concern for fairness and the desire for clean water for all of us and from all of us. Again, I think there's a distinction between a community wastewater plant where the community really has no actual control about what goes into the treatment system when you look at what people sometimes do. Whereas on a cruise ship, they do have some control over what's going into and out of the ship system. Further, the cruise ship is profit-driven, and they have benefit from externalizing costs from lower water quality. If they can save a bit of money by having a lower water quality standard, that is reflected in the payment to the owners of the company. Whereas if a community cuts corners with the lower water quality standard, ultimately those of us who live in the community are there to pay for it. In conclusion, I ask that you slow down the movement on this bill, let the science panel complete their final draft, and then see what action is warranted. Thank you.
Thank you, Ms. Hart. Appreciate that. Remaining in Juneau here is Ms. Michelle Ridgeway. Great. Please step to the microphone, give us your name and affiliation, and give us your 3 to 5 minutes, please.
Thank you, Mr. Co-Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Michelle Ridgeway. I'm a resident of Off Bay. I'm a lifelong Alaskan, raised in Ketchikan, and my entire life has been spent in or on the water around here. I would like to first acknowledge that I served as a member of the state's science advisory panel for the wastewater issue. I felt that was it's been a great honor to work with a very highly qualified panel, and I respect fully all the individuals with whom I work. Also, as a matter of fairness, I thought I would let you know that I am an individual that served on the panel, but I also felt compelled to submit a letter to Commissioner Larry Hartig expressing some of my concerns regarding the final interpretations of findings on our panel report. Because some of those findings have been propagated through the development of reports from the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation and their letters to you and testimony, I felt it was important to flag some of my concerns.
Ms. Ridgeway,
I will submit that letter for the record, if you wish.
I would just clarify, you're speaking on behalf of yourself now?
I'm speaking on my own behalf,
okay,
yes, sir.
Thank you.
So beyond introducing myself to members of the committee, I simply wanted to reiterate that we certainly have a tremendous environment to make a stand for, and Alaska always has. We fight farmed salmon vehemently. We fight frankenfish. We fight anything that might impact salmon industry, and our fish and wildlife overall, and I think that now is the time to continue that course. I have come to this meeting to familiarize myself with HB 80 and the implications of that bill. I have very deep concerns regarding passage of the bill at this time because it appears that technologically and scientifically we are arriving at the point we have envisioned with regard to balancing a great industry with sustaining our marine ecosystem. I strongly encourage you to further examine the science available on the implications of cruise ship effluent on salmon, oyster farms, mussels, plankton, whales, seals, other organisms that are acutely and chronically affected by the levels of cruise ship toxins being discharged under the general permit at present, and it would be allowed in these yet-to-be-defined mixing zones. And finally, in response to conversations regarding the planning for where these mixing zones may be located, there are very sensitive habitats within the 0 to 3 nautical mile range that is Alaska's state waters. Someone has mentioned already the critical habitats. In undertaking the very challenging task of identifying where in state waters is not so sensitive, we'll bump up against areas where there's subsistence harvesting of black seaweed, where there's commercial farming of oyster farms that bioaccumulate heavy metals. We'll come across very critically important fishing grounds for our small and large boat fisheries. I think it will be very challenging to find locations where we would find it acceptable to discharge contaminants that will not have long-term deleterious effects on our marine ecosystem. Again, I strongly encourage you to stay the course. I think that we're very close to achieving success. And like I encourage all of our students to do, when the going gets tough, we stick with it. When we're challenging them to become innovators in their technology courses, the STEM program, and we say, let's find solutions that are technologically and scientifically based, then let's be the example. Stick to sound science and advance the technology to solve our challenges. Thank you.
And Mr. Ridgway, with the committee's indulgence, I'm going to ask a brief question. I did, Ms. Ridgway, I did get a look at your letter, actually, and it does, you strongly disagree, all caps. I do not concur, all caps. I strongly disagree. Did you register this disagreement in a report or with other members at the time of the process?
Mr. Co-Chair, members of the committee, we had many very productive meetings as a panel. Again, I'm not here to speak about the panel process or the report. You have the report. In general, many perspectives are presented in that report.
Is yours.
When it came to the findings, selected perspectives are presented in the ultimate findings in that report. And I have clarified the three elements specifically by sentence in the findings with which I did not agree throughout the meetings, verbally and in writing.
So your strongly object, your strongly disagreement are or are not reflected in the report in writing?
Not in the findings section of the report, sir.
Thank you very much. Brief question? Brief question.
In your testimony, you mentioned mixing zones.
Yes, sir.
And you said as yet to be undetermined size of a mixing zone. Your input here, what is an appropriate size for a mixing zone? Currently, we're telling them it has to be at the point of discharge, coming out the pipe, the side of the, actually inside the pipe in the cruise ship. What's an appropriate size mixing zone to protect the waters of the state?
Through the co-chair, the mixing zones are regulated, and there is a very specific process within DEC to establish a mixing zone. The objective, as I understand it, of a mixing zone is to identify an area sufficiently large enough such that whatever is discharged in that zone meets water quality criteria, which are based on the EPA aquatic toxicity testing standards, and yet calculating that in a water column that is highly stratified as in terms of salinity and temperature and other constituents is very, very challenging, especially when you add the fact that these vessels are moving. Therefore, first of all, in response to your question, it's certainly not to me to identify how large is it. It's identified and codified that the mixing zone must achieve water quality criteria at the edges. I find it very challenging to identify the edges of a mixing zone when we have very large vessels moving throughout their routes inside waters in southeast, crossing the Gulf, and then all the way up to the Arctic. I think it will be a tough challenge. It's been very challenging even to get information on the effluent right at the pipe at one point. Yeah. I'm afraid I can't respond in terms of how it should be done, but it is in code what it is, but the objective is clear.
Would it be appropriate to make the mixing zone relative to the size of the vessel? In other words, by the stern of the vessel?
Again, through the co-chair, sir, that is not relevant to the physical processes that must occur to sufficiently dilute a toxin to an acceptable level. The size of the stern is irrelevant. The fact that propellers and mixing has been discussed. Well, many ships don't even use those huge propellers. They use the azopods now. And so there's many, many factors that must take in the physical characteristics of the oceanographer, sort of parameters in which this is deposited, the speed of the vessel, and the size of the vessel have very little to do with how large that mixing zone should be. It's whether the objective of is met to protect clean water by meeting the water quality standards at depth and at the spatial extent of that zone, again, in a moving scenario.
I fear I've let the cats or the camel's nose under the tent, but given the time we have and we have three more people, that's okay. No,
can I
just say we have three people and a couple questions in the committee, so with your indulgence, stand by and we'll ask some questions.
Yeah.
Representative Johnson and then Representative Tarr.
Mr. Chairman, I think she's called in to question the entire validity of the report. If she stated dissenting views that weren't included and she stated at the time of the report and they didn't make it, I'm concerned that what are we doing here with this report? I mean, were people, was she not allowed if she made an effort to dissent and wasn't? I mean, so I want to clarify at what point, I mean, are you here because of, you thought, I just want to know where you dissented and why isn't it in the report? Did you dissent during the committee process or was it afterwards that you wrote the letter?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Johnson, I'm here because I'm an Alaskan who cares very much about balancing our, sustaining our ecosystem, our fisheries, our communities with industry, which we have many. I extend the courtesy to you of coming in this room to introduce myself because there is a letter out there, my letter. It does state on three sentences specific findings that are captured in the report with which I disagreed during the committee process. I'm not here to hindcast how that committee process occurred. You have ADEC staff who were involved in that process that can explain that more fully if you wish. And I understood that certainly it might raise questions. Unfortunately, I really cannot speak on the panel's behalf, nor on the process that was undertaken. Okay. Thank you.
Ms. Ridgeway, I'm actually afraid you haven't answered his question, so I'd appreciate if you would, please.
Would you like to restate your question?
Yeah. Did you offer I guess the three points as you state them, to the commission board, and they did not include those in the report?
Through the co-chair, Representative Johnson, during the course of our deliberations, and you can imagine a very busy, lengthy process of group writing of a report, I disagreed with the three sentences, which I've highlighted in my letter, consistently. And yet, again, in respect to my fellow panel members, many people agree. It's simply, I wanted to clarify that I flagged those three consistently, and I still do have concerns regarding those three things.
Representative Johnson.
Thank you. It is my understanding that they made provisions for dissenting opinions. And I didn't read yours in here. Did you not submit them as a dissenting opinion to the board?
Mr. Co-Chair, Representative Johnson, my opinion, as well as that of all the panelists, were discussed through many in-person and teleconference meetings. And I guess I'd leave it at that. I expressed my opinion. It's largely in the report. There are some ultimate findings with which I disagreed. I offered the letter to Commissioner Harding simply to clarify those points.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I've heard enough.
Thank you. I would note for the record that the DEC report was dated November 1st, 2012. Ms. Ridgeway's letter is dated January 17th, 2013. Representative Tarr, the question.
Okay. Thank you. I just wanted to talk a little bit about the dilution factor, and we're using EPA standards, I believe, for that. And when do you feel like when they set those standards, they reflected what happens in a Arctic, or more cold water environment? And should there be additional work done in Alaska to answer, I guess, my colleague's question about understanding mixing zones better for our environment?
through the co-chair, Representative Tarr, if I understand your question correctly, you're asking my opinion regarding should we obtain better information about the oceanographic features of Alaskan waters for improving our ability to potentially predict the spatial extent of a zone in which a suite of contaminants in the effluent might be potentially diluted to the point of meeting water quality criteria?
Exactly.
Yes, I do support that research.
Thank you very much, Ms. Ridgway. Thanks for testifying. We have up next in the room Mr. Chip Toma. You're here to and give us your name, who you represent, and give us 3 to 5 minutes of your testimony. Thank you, sir.
For the record, my name is Chip Toma. I'm the president of Responsible Cruising Alaska. We formed in 1997 to get a head tax for Juneau, which was successful. And also then we did the state initiative in 2006 to set up the laws and the taxes that we're talking about today. Briefly, my testimony on HB 80 is that my preference and the preference of responsible cruising is that large cruise ships discharge into federal waters, not into state waters. You avoid all complications. You don't have to get a state permit. It's a wonderful system. You're permitted and legal to dump waste beyond the 3-mile limit. So that would be the preference. Unfortunately, we have a large number of ships still in the Alaska fleet that have small holding capacities and in some cases are riddled with copper pipes. And the combination of those two is deadly because they have wastewater that's has very high copper counts and they don't have the holding capacity to go to federal waters. So those ships, primarily the Princess fleet, are now discharging in Juneau. And they have a separate hookup for the Princess fleet down here at the cruise ship dock, and that goes directly into the plant. Now, I'm unaware whether a ship a day discharges into that, 7 ships or not, but I think it's on a pretty regular basis. So that's a total Princess operation. That's their deal through a private dock and our city treatment plant. They pay for that service. I've heard that they do not like the solids, which Ms. Ken, I think, expressed. We can't handle heavy solids here, all the grease and everything that comes through, but we can handle basic wastewater. And if it's a question of getting that kind of volume off the ship, Juneau can do that. Now, the great news for Juneau, and I think for Southeast Alaska specifically, is that the new cruise ship dock that's going to be built here is going to have 4 hookups, 2 municipal and 2 private hookups that the head tax pays for, and those are also going to be, of course, hooked into this Juneau treatment plant. So, theoretically, 4 ships a day could discharge wastewater only, not solids, but wastewater only of not a high grease content into the treatment plant. But we have a local man, Jim Dorn, Carson and Dorn, that's been working very closely with the private industry and with the city and with the cruise ships to set all that up. And it's in the last stages right now of being approved. We start construction on that dock this winter. So all these hookups are going to be put in and they're going to be operational by 2015. That's the great news. The other great news, in my perspective, and I'm not going to read my testimony or go through all this, but from my perspective, the best news on the horizon for the cruise ship industry is they're no longer building ships with copper pipes, or to my knowledge, with a lot of galvanized pipes. So all this nickel and zinc and copper is going to all go away as soon as these ships get redeployed and get sent somewhere else. And to my knowledge, I'm not a scientist. I went to a lot of parochial schools. We didn't stress science too much. But I understand that copper only affects salmon. It doesn't affect tuna. It doesn't affect mackerel. So these ships could go somewhere else in the world. And if we had flex pipe ships up here, we wouldn't have a heavy metals problem. The other interesting aspect of this, we've had a lot of talk about our sewage treatment plants, the high amount of copper. And that's not the issue so much as the bunker water. What kind of water are we putting on these ships? If we're putting on water on these ships that's higher than the 3 parts per billion in copper, well, that's kind of a bad situation. So when Commissioner Hardy got asked that question the other day in the Senate resources, he didn't know the answer to that. So I went ahead and made calls for about 1 hour, and I called the superintendents of the water utilities in Ketchikan and Juneau and Skagway, the three main towns that supply the bunker water for these ships. In the case of Ketchikan, just a small anecdote, they had a high copper count, 17 parts per billion, and a huge, in my estimation, lead count, 70 parts per billion, on the dock, all right, after the test. And the superintendent went down the dock, and he looked at the new ball joint fitting, and it was brand new, and it was metal, and it was made of India, and he replaced that with a plastic ball joint, and they did an 8-hour test. They let the water sit for 8 hours, did a retest, and the retest was 2 parts per billion copper and 0.6 parts per billion lead. And obviously the source was that one ball joint, okay? In Skagway, a very, very similar situation. They held extensive tests that were requested by the cruise company. In fact, Mr. Wetzel testified, Admiralty Environmental conducted those tests. I gave a copy of that to Representative Wilson earlier today. They tested 3 docks in Skagway, 2 municipal and 1 private dock. The municipal docks came in at 1 and less than 1 parts per billion of copper, the purest water in Alaska probably. And on the private dock, which is getting the same water from the same treatment plant, they've got 6 to 9 parts per billion copper and higher counts for heavy metals. Mm-hmm. And I asked the superintendent, what's the deal? And he said, it's got to be the fittings. They've got older fittings over in that White Pass dock, and that's the deal. Right. And you know, it's 3 parts per billion, and that's the end of my testimony.
Let me ask you, does that give you the opportunity to summarize?
Absolutely.
But if you're done, Representative Feige has a brief question.
Just a question. When you say bunker water, are you talking about the water that the ships take on?
Correct.
To then use for people to drink and wash their teeth?
Exactly. And then it gets discharged. That same water goes through the whole system, gets heated, goes through all those copper pipes, and then they want to discharge it. That's the water, though.
Okay, so that's not coming from the cruise ship?
No, it comes from us, and it comes from Vancouver and Seattle. So they fill up in Vancouver and Seattle, and then they refill in either Ketchikan or Juneau or Skagway.
Okay.
But all our water in Southeast, I can't speak for Vancouver and Seattle, all our water in Southeast is below the 3 parts per billion. That's the important takeaway from all this. We're putting pure water on board these ships, and when it's coming out, it's high in copper and heavy metals because of their leaching pipes.
Right. Okay.
All due to water softeners.
Right.
It's all about shampoos and showers. Okay. It has nothing more to do than shampoos and showers.
Thank you, Mr. Dolan. Thank you very much. We have time for 2 more people, one in person and one online. We'll go online to Petersburg, where Mr. Eric Lee has been waiting patiently. And if Mr. Eric Lee can hear me, please put yourself on the record and give us your 3 to 5 minutes of common testimony.
Yes, I hear you fine, and I've been really appreciating the discussion so far. I've learned a lot, as all the other people have too. I'm a commercial fisherman here in Petersburg, third generation. My grandpa came here over 100 years ago, so been in the business a long time, and I'm very concerned about the salmon runs here in Southeast Alaska because they have declined. The native runs, the hatchery runs, are doing fine. But anyway, I'm very concerned about the levels of dissolved copper in the water. It's something we don't know very much about. It's kind of a fledgling science at this point, but we do know that the dissolved copper on has an effect on the salmon's sense of smell. It's well documented, and it's a very, very toxic. It's even the short-term influxes of copper to surface water interferes with olfactory functioning, which is critical for the successful migration of the salmon back to their streams. And it's becoming more and more established that the level of toxicity can be just as low as a few parts per billion. And that makes it kind of an invisible world that we haven't really gotten into and done any science research about the broader effects of that fact. And we do know that the discharge water is fresh water. It's not salt water, so it stays on top or near the surface for quite a while when it gets into this salt water. And it mixes with the same fresh water that's near the surface that the salmon depend on for their scent memories that leads them back to their stream of origin. So
I think that it's probably could have a very detrimental effect. And it affects all the fisheries here in Southeast Alaska, not just the salmon commercial fishing, but also the sport fishing, which is huge here. So I just think that we really, before relaxing standards in any way, allowing mixing zones, we need to do a lot of more discussion and determine what the facts really are. More scientific research would be helpful. One thing I think that I kind of think might be a pertinent area of investigation is the fact that there is a distinction between water coming from a ship and a shore-based source, in that from a shore-based source, the source is relatively constant, and it's very likely part of the sense memory of the out-migrating salmon, whereas cruise ships are floating cities. They're movable cities, and the discharge of their water is more random and variable, and therefore it's not part of the out-migrating salmon scent memory when they return from their ocean to their native streams. That's a whole new scent that's and a disorienting factor from the copper that's dissolved in the water. So, you know, it's a new science, and there's lots to be learned, but I have major concerns about that. And so I, in closing, I urge you not to support HB 80. I think that a lot more research needs to be done, and until then, we need to maintain our present levels of standards for heavy metals and without mixing zones. So that's all. And I appreciate very much this discussion and my ability to participate. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Lee. I appreciate your testimony. And again, if you have comments in writing, please submit them to the committee, to the LIO operator there in Petersburg, if you could. One more person signed up to testify. We have Mr. William Johnson. And is he online or is he in the room? William Johnson?
Yeah, good afternoon. My name is William Johnson. I'm calling from Anchorage.
Great. Did you represent anybody, sir? And let us know who you're...
I represent myself, and I used to run a sewage treatment plant in Prudhoe Bay at our camps. And so I know a little about the, you know, treatment of sewage plants.
Great. Go ahead, sir.
And I oppose the House Bill 80, Cruise Ship Wastewater Discharge. And, you know, the cruise industry bought this on themselves. They were putting some really bad stuff in the water, dry cleaning chemicals, photo-developing chemicals and stuff like that, and dumping them in state waters. And, you know, they went to the legislature and wanted this stopped, and finally it took a citizen initiative to get this law what we have now. And I hate to see us roll this back. And you know, if they're going to come into our waters, they can dump their tanks out in the federal waters way offshore, and then when they come into state waters, they can start putting it in their tanks. And if they're running out of room, I don't see no problems with them dumping it in, you know, the municipality's sewage system, because sewer is sewer. And they're, what I understand, these new cruise ships now, their gray water, their shower, their sinks, the dishwater, all goes into a gray tank, and all the toilets go into the sewage treatment plant, and they're supposed to have the same kind of plants that we have, you know, on the slope. And when we get done processing this stuff, it's supposed to be drinkable water, but I would never drink it, but we dump it on the tundra. And I oppose this, and I feel it's a slap in the face of all Alaskans for this governor trying to roll back these wastewater discharges. So that's what I got to say on this.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Again, if you've got written comments or a letter you want to submit, please give it to them at the LIO. Is there anybody else?
Have a good day, and thanks for letting me talk.
Thanks, sir. Anybody else in person who'd like to testify? Miss, you want to come forward and give us your name and affiliation, and got just a couple minutes for you, please.
Thank you. I came in late, so I didn't get signed up. But I'm from Haines. Came in on the ferry yesterday.
And what your name is?
Kathleen Menke.
Can you spell that, please, for the record?
M-E-N-K-E.
Thank you, Kathleen.
Kathleen with a K. I came to Alaska 20 years ago. I've lived in Haines that whole time. We eat salmon, halibut, bullion, crab, shrimp. Everybody in Alaska does. When I lived in Colorado for 5 years, I was a water and wastewater treatment operator, Class A, highest level of 4 levels, be certified. First woman in the state of Colorado to get that. I just want to say that mixing zones is not a way to regulate discharge. Whatever you want to monitor, you need to monitor at the point of discharge. I don't want to speak to what level that should be or not, but that's where it needs to be monitored. It is impossible to regulate or enforce mixing zones, and particularly on moving cruise ships in oceans. So I hope you'll take that into consideration, give us all a lot more thought.
Thank you very much. Appreciate you making it on the ferry. That's good. Anybody else wish to testify? Other gentlemen. I'm going to have to hold you to 3 minutes, sir, if you give us your name and quick testimony.
Certainly. My name is Andy Rogers, and I'm the Deputy Director for the Alaska State Chamber of Commerce. And in the interest of time, I'm going to read my comments. The Alaska State Chamber...
You can certainly give them to us in writing, too, if you'd like.
Absolutely. I'll make these available to the committee. The Alaska State Chamber of Commerce is the statewide chamber representing hundreds of diverse businesses across the state and thousands of working Alaskans. The majority of our members are small businesses. And together, our members share one common goal, and that is to make Alaska a viable and competitive place to do business. So thank you for hearing HB 80 today. And please know that this bill and its companion in the Senate, SB 29, have the full support of the Alaska Chamber and its members. It's our hope that this bill will enjoy bipartisan support and you'll pass it through your committee today. Each year, the Alaska Chamber members gather to identify our legislative priorities for the upcoming session. And for the past several years, Chamber members have named this issue as one that they would like to see changed. Specifically, the position this year supports changing point of discharge regulation to a standard that is both attainable and protects the environment. And the current permitting practices also have an impact on several of the Alaska Chamber's other priorities. Specifically, Alaska Chamber members have adopted a position to advocate for legislation and regulations that are based on sound science rather than precautionary methods. And so in 2009, with HB 134 charging ADEC to create the science panel to evaluate technology and feasibility for the 2006 standards, the science panel held their first meetings in 2010 and met 15 times. So they spent a considerable amount of time evaluating current treatment systems on board cruise ships, other technologies to determine feasibility of meeting the initiative standards. The results published earlier this January affirm that cruise ships operating in Alaskan waters enjoy the most advanced and efficient treatment systems available. Their discharge meets higher standards than water discharge by any municipal treatment plant in the state of Alaska. And I think this is an encouraging set of results for an industry that's very, very important for Alaska's coastal communities. But in addition to supporting regulation on sound science, Alaska Chamber members support consistency and predictability in Alaska's permitting process. The general permit issued in 2010 was subject to lengthy and costly litigation to administrative appeal, and I think it's reasonable to expect that any new permits issued would be subject to similar litigation. I think this could threaten Alaska's competitive appeal as a market for an industry where resources are highly mobile and schedules need to be set years and years in advance. So the importance of this issue to the economic health of the state I don't think can be overstated. Cruise ship industry has an obvious impact on various coastal communities, but however, private sector businesses across the state have joined together to indicate that the continued presence of cruise ship traffic affects communities and businesses deep into the interior and throughout the state. This is a fragile industry by Alaskan standards. It's a renewable resource, but it's also a very mobile one. So cruise ships bring tens of thousands of visitors to our port communities and can be redeployed to venues with reasonable permitting and attainable standards. The Alaska Chamber recognizes that the impact of the reduction or loss of cruise ship passengers will impact most of our state and many of our communities. Most cruise ship passengers disembark to participate in some form of economic activity. Businesses like Alaska Amphibious Tours in Ketchikan, Alaska Brewing Company right here in Juneau, they create jobs, they generate revenue, and in part that's due to cruise ship traffic. According to the Alaska Cruise Association, more than one-fifth of passengers traveling on cross-the-Gulf itineraries participate in an extended land tour. So many of those move up through Denali into Fairbanks, where hundreds of businesses like Pike's Landing, Hot Licks Homemade Ice Cream, create thousands of jobs and the Alaskan experience for our guests. So to close,
please.
So this issue has statewide implications, and the Alaska Chamber is hopeful that HB 80 will pass through House Resources and that members of this committee will encourage the body to pass this bill into law. Thank you again for this opportunity, and I will make these comments available to the committee.
Thank you very much, and I appreciate that. And seeing no one else and seeing no one online to testify, we'll close the public hearing. And thank everyone who took time to come here in person or on telephone for testifying. Thank you to the commissioner, deputy commissioner, and director. We're going to take this bill up again on Monday, and I'd like to remind committee members that any amendments you'd like to submit and discuss on Monday should be in 24 hours in advance, given the weekend, preferably tonight. That'd be much valued. Scheduled for 1 o'clock on Friday, is for Monday, January 25th at 1 o'clock. We will also hear HB 36, which is exempt discharges from use of munitions and bills previously heard. This one.
Mr. Chair.
Final question.
Comments with a question. The procedure that we had today, not being able to ask people who are testifying questions and not having time for us to be able to ask our questions, and then all of a sudden closing testimony, I don't think is a good way of a public process. I think we should be able to ask our questions with our people who are testifying while they're at the mic, so we don't disconvenient them from stepping aside and coming back, and not disconvenient us from being able to ask the questions. I think that in the future, I hope that we're able to ask questions to those that were testifying so we can get clarification right away.
Right.
And so will we have an opportunity to be able to ask people these questions, or do we have a list of, I mean, if you're going to go down this route, then at least have them give us their contact information so we can ask our questions. But I think it's good to have that on public record for everybody to hear.
Thank you for your questions, Representative Tuck. We'll be talking. We are adjourned.